Hi, we're Eleanor and Carrie. We're the hosts of the Good Robot Podcast, and join us as we ask the experts, what is good technology? Is it even possible? And what does feminism have to bring to this conversation? If you want to learn more about today's topic, head over to our website, where we've got a full transcript of the episode and a specially curated reading list with work by or picked by our experts. But until then, sit back, relax, and enjoy the episode.
In this episode, Sophie, who's the author of Full Surrogacy Now and self-defined wayward Marxist, talks about defining good technology for the whole of the biosphere, why the purity of the human species has always been contaminated by our animal and technological origins, why nature is much, much stranger than we think, what that means for the lambs that are now being grown in artificial wombs, and why technologies like birth control and IVF can never liberate women within the power dynamics of our capitalist present. We hope you enjoy the show.
So Sophie, thank you so much for joining us here today. So just to kick us off, could you tell us a bit about who you are, what you do, and what brought you to the questions of gender, feminism, and technology?
Yes. Hi. Thank you so much for having me on. So I'm a freelance, or I guess you could say independent, hybrid para-academic with sort of many strings, probably too many strings to my bow. I teach short courses that are currently online at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. And I encourage anyone listening to look at what's on offer there and register, you know, if there are topics that interest them, because it's a fun, non-graded kind of educational social theory seminar. I do a lot of speaking gigs, which started happening after I published my first book with the leftist publishing house Verso. I also have this unpaid position as a visiting scholar at the Center for Research in Feminist, Queer, and Transgender Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, which is near where I live in Philadelphia in the US. But you could just say I'm a writer at this point, really, notwithstanding the 10 years I put in academia, first at Oxford, doing a BA in English Literature, and then an MA in Environmental Policy, then at the New School in New York, doing another MA in Politics, and finally at Manchester University, doing a PhD in Human Geography. And it's almost 5 years, no, it's over 5 years since I completed that PhD. And it was a strange thing for me realizing one day after a couple of years of really struggling with uncertainty as to, you know, whether I wanted an academic job, that I was actually the thing I always wanted to be as a child, which is to say a writer. And somehow I'm just about making it work. Although I should mention that, like many creative laborers in this neo-feudal age, I have a Patreon and supporters on there cover more or less exactly my rent. Anyway, you asked what brought me to gender, feminism, and tech. And I have a sort of simple answer to that, really, which is Donna Haraway's 1985 socialist manifesto for cyborgs, which I read, I think, at the age of 16, although I want to specify I did not understand it at all at that time. But even at 16 years old, I somehow knew overwhelmingly that it was right, that it was true, that there was something there about the necessary sort of interpenetration of feminism and, you know, techno-contaminated historicity that was needful and exciting, not to mention the language and the sort of mode of expression and communication. The person, the personality behind this text resonated. And I suppose, I hope, I aspire to having a similar sort of humorous, passionate, kind of ironically sincere, sort of sincerely ironic approach to my, you know, liberation writing. Yeah.
I think that humor is so important because feminism isn't usually associated with humor.
Yeah.
And yeah, the style of writing, and for those people who are listening who haven't read Donna Haraway's A Manifesto for Cyborgs. It's an amazing text and really tongue-in-cheek, but also very serious about the kind of problems with contemporary technology, looking into the future, seeing the kind of racialized labor that would and was a problem. At that time, she was just really ahead of the game. I think on that note, you know, here are $3 billion questions. What is good technology? Is it even possible? And how can feminism help us get there? And please, we'd love your take on that, with or without references to Haraway.
Thank you. Okay. Initially, when one thinks about this, I think it's easy to be tempted to sort of overthink the technology part of the question and perhaps underthink the goodness element. So like, oh gosh, okay, how do we even define a technology? Do we want to define it as simply, you know, tools or applied science or, you know, whatever is designed I suppose there are lots of definitions. Or perhaps it's sort of like, quick, what good technologies can we think of? You know, perhaps insulin pumps or dishwashers or glasses or smoke-free cooking stoves or the printing press or the pill, you know, or vaccines. And the implicit goodness of that list, you know, off the top of my head is, I suppose, vaguely humanist, right? I.e., you know, good tech is tech that saves human lives or lengthens human lifespans or improves human, quote unquote, quality of life. But I think, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be horribly upset if I had to stand by that answer. But as you well know, and by the way, this is a fantastic question to structure a podcast around, the question of goodness in conjunction with technology is so much more complicated, especially when subjecting humanism to critical scrutiny as a category of thought from a critical race theory perspective, for example, and when subjecting humanism to the sort of critique that sees it as difficult to disarticulate from colonialism, and especially when trying to define goodness for the whole of the biosphere and for more than human forms of life. So, as some species of wayward Marxist, my criteria for desirable tech might be its affordances for struggles of liberation. So this means, this gets really sticky and difficult, but it might mean, for example, that I'm not sure how useful it is to put even all the abominable machines of military destruction, guns and so on, simply in some kind of bad technology box, since weapons have been used historically against oppressive forces and not just by them. Understanding that doesn't preclude naming the reasons for the historical emergence of, you know, nuclear missiles or machine guns or whatever, as capitalism and empire and patriarchy. But I think, unfortunately, once technologies are made, they probably aren't going to be unmade in the absence of a massive generalized effort to unmake the conditions of possibility for their invention in the first place. So I suppose my stance here is hopefully legible as, Haraway-ian. For empirical and political reasons, I would rather be a cyborg than a goddess. You know, so empirical reasons and political ones, you know, to do with what is, you know, the cyborg as a sort of diagnosis of the human animal in its materiality, as well as a sort of orientation and a speculative fabulation to constitute a collective subject. It seems to me indisputable that feminists must face up to the contaminated, historically situated, sort of part animal, part machinic character of our very selves, and so face up to this, you know, or to, you know, quote, beep bullshit, face up to this or lapse into various species of nostalgic or woundedly attached or queer phobic or sex worker exclusionary or anti-trans bioconservativism. A technophobic ecofeminism doesn't just not appeal to me then. It strikes me as actively harmful. And for instance, in the worldwide assault on transgender children that is underway today, we can trace, I think, quite easily the influence of a technophobic ecofeminist understanding of the human body as somehow redeemable from contamination or somehow purifiable and somehow metaphysically sexed according to an immutable binary. And, you know, I want to just, share that I had this extraordinary encounter in person with Donna Haraway after I had disagreed with some of her more recent writing about kin making. And one thing she said to me with the most extraordinary sort of friendship was, Sophie, you are an ecofeminist, which I think she quite understandably thought would be maybe a bit provocative or unwelcome. I said, yes, of course, because you taught me that the eco or the sort of the domain of the natural to which we might refer as feminists is, way stranger than we could possibly imagine. And that we feminists, need not be afraid of the biological and what it might, dictate. and we don't have a choice anyway. We must engage with the biological.
I love that about Haraway because, I think people listening might think that feminists are trying to run away from biology or essentialism. And you just said something about this very beautiful line that people will probably be asking about, which is, it talks about an immutable binary, and being metaphysically sexed. Can you just explain to us very quickly what you mean by that?
Sometimes things in the world of technology are complicated and need careful explaining. Sometimes they just need a little hard truth.
I don't think anyone is going to buy a banana with crypto at any point in the foreseeable future.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, the host of Slate's What Next TBD, your clear-eyed guide to technology, power, and the future. Friday and Sunday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ah, okay. I'm really interested in some of the work that, for example, the historian Jules Gill Peterson is doing at the moment. She's the author of, amongst other things, Histories of the Transgender Child. And she's also got work coming out on, the sort of history of transmisogyny. I see it as very much part of a new sort of materialist kind of feminism that's actually rejecting the idea that feminism was sort of, cisgender first, maybe I should be answering the question more directly first. I think I am skeptical that sex in our species sort of is immutably dyadic and binary in a way that sort of pre-exists or is separable from the social, right? There isn't a sort of natural binary sex reality that you can actually separate from the language and the thought categories and the sort of scientific medical edifices that have sort of purported to just identify but have perhaps constructed that self-understanding, which becomes very very concrete, very material, very real, very sort of palpable, tangible, but nevertheless isn't sort of trans-historic or forever. And Emma Heaney is another extraordinary sort of historian of the way in which feminism became cis. And this is sort of a turning on its head of the, received and maybe mainstream understandings of, the category of, transgender as, a parvenu, lately sort of interloping or, you know, sort of novel presence in history. I think, yeah, it's also quite Eurocentric and perhaps, you know, epistemically sort of colonial to imagine that gender and sex the world over have been, for one thing, kind of separable in that way that, you know, a lot of sort of, you know, 101 sort of feminist understandings and, you know, like to just really separate out gender and sex. But, you know, this perhaps is not the only way to do it, because it that plays into a clean separation between, you know, the domain of sort of the natural and the domain of the cultural, right? Mm-hmm. Like we have a sort of sex substratum on which our genders then play. And this isn't really how, you know, truly cyborg understandings of the material semiotic matrix in which we all swim would have it. So yeah, I think, you know, our embodiment and its sexedness is in flux, is created. We are all sort of endocrinologically and socially and, you know, prosthetically sort of moving and self and mutually created. You know,
that's a really beautiful way of putting it. I love the idea of kind of being prosthetically mutually created. And I think some of, you know, I also really loved what you were saying as well earlier, and through that answer as well, about the kind of fetishization of the natural and how that natural is also common to be understood as a kind of naturalized sex binary, which you've really beautifully unpicked there. And, you know, I think some of the work that I find really exciting on this topic comes from like my own field, Asian diaspora studies. And someone we have on the podcast, Michelle Huang, has this fantastic art piece called, I think, Robots, Clones and Aliens, which is kind of thinking about the way that this kind of fetishization of the natural is also kind of racializing in this, the techno-orientalist sense, and the way that certain kinds of like racialized genders become like bound up with technology, and that kind of entwinement is used to dehumanize. And that's why I think work like hers and work like yours like just is so important. But on this question of kind of like fetishizing like what is understood to be natural and how that naturalization is like completely like an operation of power, I actually wanted to ask you about, you know, you mentioned earlier your first book, which came out with Verso, called Full Surrogacy Now, which made real shockwaves when it hit. It's a fantastic book. Highly recommend checking it out to all our listeners. But could you break down for our listeners, what is the core argument of your book? What is it about? Plot twist, it is about kind of unpinning the idea of the family. And how do you think technology is going to help us get there? Or what role do you think technology should play in that?
Thanks. Yeah, so Full Surrogacy Now, Feminism Against Family, it sounds like it might be a book about what we think of as surrogacy, you know, in the media, including in sort of feminist anti-surrogacy campaigns and talking points, which are often very much of a piece with, you know, anti sort of trans and sort of sex work prohibitionist types of feminism. So surrogacy in that context is a really stable sort of signifier. It means, you know, a sort of outsourcing of what I would call gestational labor, so that a baby becomes, you know, manufactured by quote unquote somebody else, you know, by somebody else than the baby's parents, right? And that's supposed to, you know, that then there are lots of bioethical conversations about that on those terms that are very sort of established. And I was really shocked in a sense in my academic kind of meanderings where I was coming onto this topic, because in a sense it is a reworking of my PhD, you know, work really, that the panels that I would see at conferences, at symposiums, would have sort of a really clean segregation between assisted reproductive technologies, quote unquote, and then questions to do with, you know, maternity and family and mothering and, you know, and so basically the phrase that I came up with in my head one time was that the phrase assisted reproduction implies that, you know, quote unquote, natural reproduction is unassisted, or it implies that there is such a thing as unassisted reproduction. And I think as a, you know, a disloyal daughter of Donna Haraway, I really dispute the idea that there could be a form of, you know, anthrogenesis, to use a maybe overly fancy word, right? The manufacture of human beings, right? I dispute that we could be the makers of one another in purely sort of one-to-one individualized ways, right? I think, you know, the bad and the good news, if you like, is that we are constantly at work manufacturing one another, you know, badly, if you like, right? Speak about bad technology or good. Full surrogacy now has a sort of dual valence. It's on the one hand, a description of the deeply sort of stratified reality of planetary reproduction in a class society, right? Where, you know, racialized and feminized labor is constantly sort of being purchased and brought in to the supposedly, you know, autonomous, usually white sort of bourgeois ruling class household to care for its members. You know, there's a lot of actual sociological data on how white upper class families are perceived by basically all of us as literally needing, like requiring more care. And so, you know, this image of the family as a sort of autonomous organism is such an outrageous sort of fiction. It's incredible that it's sustained. I mean, in a sense, you could read a lot of culture as kind of propping it up, right? I'm a firm believer in the role in which things like TV have in, for example, legitimizing the police, right? There are so many, you know, TV shows that are about identifying with cops. By the same token, I sort of wonder if the private nuclear household would be quite so, you know, you know, robust if it weren't for the, you know, million representations of it that we have. In reality, it's fictional. That doesn't mean it's not a hugely effective disciplinary frame. And it's so I suppose I said it sounds like my book is a book about surrogacy. On the one hand, it's a diagnosis of the sort of bad, sort of uneven and combined, you know, outsourcing distribution of reproductive labor. And on the other hand, it's a utopian cry, a critically utopian cry, critical utopianism being a sort of perhaps decolonial strain within utopian studies that thinks about utopia almost as a method of negation of the given, the naturalized, and insists on a kind of negationism, on an insistence on a livable world, right? Full surrogacy now, in that, you know, utopian sense, is an actualization of the way in which we are each other's harvest and each other's, you know, manufacturers. So a comradely mode beyond the sort of legal and economic fictions of private property and biogenetic centered kinship in which we would have, you know, communized care, something like that. What role can technology play in this is a great question. I am, you know, techno-open, techno-curious, but also, and I think this is not contradictory, quite techno-pessimistic in a capitalist present, right? I think that makes sense, right? I am, as I think you probably know, kind of someone who's poked around in the hospital near my house in Philadelphia, where ectogenetic technology is actually being tested and developed and researched. So I've written an article about the so-called biobag, which is an ectogenetic medium for gestating unborn. I usually never use that word. Lambs, right? Like, sort of fetal sheep. I guess I said unborn because I really think of the ideological drivers behind this research and development as essentially a pro-life, you know, quote unquote, agenda. You know, the funding from the Trump administration came from parties who are interested in establishing fetal personhood and using this technology very much against the best interests of, you know, the people I might call gestators rather than, you know, women, because I don't think the two categories need to be assimilated. And so very much with the proponent, the infamous proponent of, machine uteruses, Shulamith Firestone, who wrote The Dialectic of Sex before disappearing forever from the scene of feminism in 1970. I'm deeply sort of pessimistic about any role for ectogenesis, you know, within capitalism or in the absence of a really concerted, massive, generalized, struggle to wrest control of technologies from the hands of, the proponents of forced gestation, right? I'm in the US. The other category that is currently under attack is, of course, abortion, right? Transgender children and abortion. I will say, Firestone and I mean, I find this very humbling, but I we're put in the same sort of sentences a lot, right? And I'm very honored because I find Firestone extraordinarily exciting and moving. I also disagree with, I think, more of her individual sort of statements than not. There is an absolutely unforgivable chapter on race in The Dialectic of Sex, and there's also a lot of sort of strange machismo and frankly nonsense throughout The Dialectic of Sex, but I still love it as a critical utopian bombshell. It's again the humor, right? Actually, Haraway is perhaps the rightful inheritor of the sort of Firestonian sort of title in our society. But, I'm sick to death of the way in which Firestone is still haunting the mainstream liberal imaginary as supposedly this, techno-euphoric, optimistic kind of, fan of machine uteruses, because this is what she actually says, if you don't mind, like, quote, "Cybernation, like birth control, can be a double-edged sword. Like artificial reproduction, to envision it in the hands of the present powers is to envision a nightmare."
Yeah. And if you Google, wombs outside of bodies, or artificial wombs and lambs, I mean, the pictures are horrific, just to warn you. But also, there's that big question that is the only question, is the really boring question of, will artificial wombs be the kind of climax of feminism? Will we be freed from our paltry biological wombs? And this, as we had Sarah Franklin, that we interviewed a couple of weeks ago, as head of sociology at Cambridge, she was like, it's a misreading of Firestone. She doesn't actually say that. So thank you so much for clarifying it for us.
Oh, well. Yeah. I apologize for the repetition in your series.
No, then. That was like extremely to the point. trying to say something different.
Maybe the extra dimension, actually, perhaps I should mention the difficulty. So you asked me to summarize the arguments of Full Surrogacy Now, and it's always hard because I do try and do so many things at once. One of the steps in the argument is that identifying, the labor of pregnancy as, gestational work is not moral praise, because I want to mention this. I feel I align myself with the philosopher of anti-work, Kathy Weeks. Thus, my hopes and desires for technology, for example, are that they might play a role in freeing humanity from work. And this, this is it might sound like an idea from the left tendency known as accelerationism, right? A trend that has sometimes distorted what was originally a rather sort of eco-anarchist idea of communal luxury or luxury communism, and turned it into a sort of high-tech vision of so-called full automation. But, as I mentioned, I think it's possible to be attuned to cyborgicity and, open and interested in the possibility, as I call it, I think in a piece about about ectogenesis elsewhere, like the low-tech grassroots, you know, ectogenesis or something, whilst also being, you know, techno-pessimist about the role that technology sort of in and of itself plays in anything, right? Even in liberatory conditions. I am a member of an ecological writing collective called Out of the Woods. And 7 years ago, together with another member of Out of the Woods, David Bell, I actually wrote a critique of Inventing the Future, which is the follow-up book by the authors of the Accelerationist Manifesto. And this essay was published in 2015 at the blog The Disorder of Things, and it's entitled Why We Can't Let the Machines Do It. And we positioned ourselves as partisans of, you know, critical utopia. And we criticized Inventing the Future for actually espousing the wrong kind of utopianism when it comes to the anti-work possibilities of automation. And one of our main points was simply that it's difficult to see how the technologies enabling automation could be produced or even, you know, self-reproduced without the continuation of what's currently some of the most dangerous and badly, if at all, paid and racialized work on the planet. The mining of raw materials, for example, for which automation looks a long way off. And at the national level, it's hard to see how demand for automation can be met given the ready, low-cost availability of incarcerated people's labor power, which is used, for example, to make circuit boards for IBM and Compaq. So I suppose that is a more sort of typical sphere in which to think about anti-work. But I actually try in Full Surrogacy Now to extend that to the labor of gestation, right? I don't think, you know, in the spirit and the tradition of wages for housework, that naming something as work is to valorize it per se, right? It's to identify a workplace to struggle in and against towards a future free of work, right? My type of Marxism is of the school in which the working class is not trying to sort of make the world in its own image or rule the world, but to abolish itself qua workers. And so anti-work anthropogenesis, if you like, is the really tricky question of how to, you know, support, resource, make safe, and so on, pregnant people, but also perhaps, yeah, keep an eye open, you know, keep a corner of your mind collectively open to things like bio bags, which might, you know, because we should be utopian about this, you know, potentially, you know, interrupt, share, distribute, you know, take the load off a human pregnancy. I do think if research and resources were poured into the question of, you know, the ability to stop gestating, but simply because one wants to, because one doesn't want to be doing forced labor, right? Unwilling labor, then perhaps we could come up with something, you know? Anyway, I'll leave it there.
Yeah, well, no, thank you so much for that. And I think, you know, you said that Full Surrogacy Now and the complexities of trying to explain what you're doing in this book is that you're trying to do so many different things. But I think that's the beauty of this work, is that it entwines, you know, such rich analyses of so many different vectors of power that have to be taken into consideration when we're thinking about something as complex as reproductive labor. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a real privilege to talk to you. I always love chatting to you. You're such a lively, delightful thinker. And again, I think at really the forefront of this wave of feminist thinking, which is taking at its heart, not just gender as it's maybe been, you know, described or identified within these particular colonialist paradigms, but kind of thinking through it much more expansively in relation to other relations of power and how those are always co-constituted. So yeah, once again, thank you so much. It's been such a delight to have you here.
Oh. Thank you both very, very much. It's an honor to have been included in your series.
This episode was made possible thanks to our generous funder, Christina Gould. It was written and produced by Dr. Eleanor Drage and Dr. Kerry Macrath, and edited by Laura Zamulio-Neaton.